Both Ira Glass and Malcolm Gladwell say today's guest is their favorite storyteller. In his books and magazine articles, Michael Lewis writes about sports, business, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, political campaigns, fatherhood, stuff that matters to a lot of people. He's smart and he has a sense of humor. Lewis was a trader at Salomon Brothers before he wrote his first bestseller, Liar's Poker, about the excesses of Wall Street during the 1980s. He continues to write about that world with his last two books, a column for Bloomberg, and articles in Vanity Fair. His newest book, Boomerang, Travels in the New Third World, is made up of articles originally published in Vanity Fair and picks up where 2010's The Big Short left off. What happens after the meltdown of 07-08? Governments are the focus of this book, mostly because they've taken on the bad debts of the too big to fail banks, so now they are themselves at risk. Now politics and culture become much more important as to how they deal with that risk. Then there's the story of California, which is a state, ran up unsustainable debts during a series of bubbles, and now is very broken. We'll talk about the twisted path taken to get the movie Moneyball into theaters. Based on his 2003 book, it's a popular and critical success, and I believe it's well worth seeing. Michael Lewis received a BA in art history from Princeton and a master's in economics from the London School of Economics. His other books include The Blind Side, Panic, The New Thing, and Home Game. Welcome again, Michael Lewis.
Good to see you.
You know, I saw Moneyball a couple of nights ago, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But I recall that the first time I interviewed you, we were supposed to talk about Moneyball, which had just come out in paperback. But we ended up spending most of the interview talking about your New York Times Magazine article about Fitz, your old baseball coach. And so that people get a sense of the role that that coach and baseball, in a way, played in your life. Who was Fitz, and what did he mean to you?
Fitz is Billy Fitzgerald, and he was, when I met him, a former minor league catcher in the Oakland A's system. He had just dropped out. I guess he got into Double A, and it concluded that Gene Tennis, not him, was going to be the big league catcher for the Oakland A's. Although he, I think, was the better defensive catcher.
So and, Mike Socia would have kept him.
Yes. And I mean, if he had been sufficiently misvalued, he might have ended up on the big league team. In any case, he turns up with Gene Tennis's mitt and lots of stories about Catfish Hunter on our high school baseball field in New Orleans at the Isadora Newman School. And I was maybe 12 or 13 when he arrived, and a driftless kid. I had stopped playing organized sports maybe 2 years before. I was doing kind of poorly in school. I wouldn't say I was unhappy, but I was just not purposeful. And he saw me playing on the schoolyard one day, just tossing a ball around, and he said, "You ought to come out for the baseball team." And I'd been a really good little league pitcher. I just stopped doing it, and I became the pitcher on the high school baseball team. And he's one of these people. I mean, I say this in the piece, but the people in your life at that age in your life, they kind of who can become voices in your head.
Mm-hmm.
If they can get inside your head at that age, they earn the right to stay there forever.
Right.
And he had this incredible intensity about him that I'd just never seen before, and none of my peers had seen before either. He was he became a character in our imaginations almost instantly, and there were all these. It turned out to be largely fictional stories about him that we heard and told each other. That he had been a really good athlete. He'd been a star baseball and basketball player at Tulane University. He had guarded Pete Maravich.
Oh my gosh.
He was the best defensive player on the basketball team. So whenever they played LSU, he guarded Maravich. But we had stories about how he'd gotten fist fights with Maravich and beaten up Maravich and his father at the same time. And it was all this kind of stuff about him.
Legend.
But it was totally plausible if you were in his presence. I mean, he was just an imposing force. And there was something about being with him that made me want to try. That's what it was. It made me really want to try. And trying on the baseball field soon became trying in all kinds of other things. And I can remember the moment I remember just how stark my transformation must have been is I had the same English teacher when I was a sophomore in high school and when I was a senior in high school. And she was the teacher nobody wanted.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she was terrifying in her own way. And she had given me a D when I was a sophomore and tried to get me basically thrown out of the school because I'd behaved so badly. And midway through my senior year, she looked at me kind of in wonder, and she said, "What happened to you? You're a changed human being. You're a pleasure to teach. You're doing extremely well." And I knew what had happened to me. What had happened to me was this interaction with this man.
Wow. And, I mean, you know, we can make up the story, but a failing English student in high school may not become a writer.
Yeah, well, then, you know, I think that what he did for me was give me a sense of possibility and a sense that limits were self-imposed, and a sense that I could try harder than anybody else. So even if I was not quite as good, that by sheer effort I could get somewhere that I wanted to go. And well, look, there's no question in my mind that without him I never would have become a writer. And he draws. He's a very intelligent man, too, and we're still very closely in touch. But he's given me he draws these elaborate analogies between pitching and writing. And there are some real similarities in the psychological state you're in when you're pitching and when you're writing. You're alone on a mound, basically. It's a collaborative enterprise in a way with the reader, but no, you're kind of alone too. And the best way to do it is by indirection. It's all about, in a funny way, tricking the reader or tricking the batter into getting them into a different place in their head.
You raise the level so you can come in low.
You pitch them inside. You are manipulating the expectations of some other person. In one case, the reader; in another case, the hitter. And so there is a lot of there's some real similarities. He's not the only reason I became a writer, but without him, he was a necessary step.
That's great. And I remember the last time we talked about writing, you said that for you, writing is about the pieces that you can take out and the spaces you can leave. And that also plays into that misdirection, doesn't it?
Absolutely. You want to leave. I mean, this sounds strange, but I think this is true. You want to leave the reader with the power to misinterpret what you're saying, so that people can come away with different views of the same story. I mean, there's a kind of, you want to be clear, but in the way the story is told, there has to be some ambiguity or else it loses interest. It feels predetermined. It feels like, you know, there's no room for the reader to exercise any kind of discretion over the story.
So in some sense, you're alone when you're writing, but it's a collaboration when they're reading.
Oh, there's no question. I mean, anybody who's written anything for publication knows that you write one thing and they read another. There can be almost opposite reactions to what you write. And you can't believe the same people are reading the same thing. I mean, you can't believe that the range of responses.
Now, one of the things I learned just recently, Michael, was that Blindside happened because of an accident when you were interviewing a former baseball teammate for the Fit story.
That's exactly right. Moneyball had come out. I decided I wanted to write this piece about my coach. I was going through Memphis anyway, and for other reasons, and I thought I knew one of my former teammates, Sean Tuohy, who's played by Tim McGraw in the movie The Blind Side, was there, and I hadn't seen him since high school. And he was Sean was an incredibly gifted athlete. He was drafted to play both pro baseball and pro basketball. He was my catcher in high school. And he was very close to the coach because his own father had been a coach and his father had had a crippling stroke when he was in high school.
And they're both catchers.
Yes. So I went to see Sean and to talk about Fitz. And Sean had been a poor boy growing up, and he'd obviously made himself very rich. And he was in this McMansion outside of Memphis, and there was this enormous black kid in his living room who didn't say a word. I mean, this was Michael Orr, and he was 6'5", 350 pounds at the time. He's in some ways bigger than he is now, and he's the right tackle for the Baltimore Ravens. He was fat, but he sat there the whole time I was talking to Sean. And no one ever explained who he was or what he was doing. And on the way out the door, I said, "You're really not going to let me get out of here without telling me what that's about. What is he doing?" He's moved in. He's Leanne's project. Leanne, and he started to tell me the story. It's actually pretty truthfully told in the movie. They saw him on the street. They knew he was this kid who had strangely gotten into their kid's school. And she stopped the car and picked him up and took him in. I didn't think I was going to write about it, but I did think it was a very curious event, and Sean and I were back in touch, and he was the announcer for the Memphis Grizzlies. He does it just for kind of fun.
Oh, no kidding.
He's the color commentator. He's on TV. And he, when they play the Warriors, he'd come out to see us in Berkeley and stay with us. And he just filled my ears with these stories about Michael's transformation. And I thought, well, one day we were out to dinner, my wife and Sean and I, and at the end of the dinner, we were both laughing and crying, and my wife turned to me and said, "If you're crazy to be writing about anything else." And I, at that point, I kind of thought, you know, there may be a book in this, but no one's, my publisher, there's nobody who's going to believe this book because nobody knows who they are. You know, this is just a random family outside of Memphis, Tennessee, engaged in this thing. The question was how to generalize it, how to tell people that this is actually a big, important story.
That's where The Blind Side tells the evolution of quarterback protection and so on.
Well,
so
what
on.
Happened was this. It became clear that there was a through line that was big, and it was, what if this kid goes from being like the least valued human being on the planet, a homeless black kid in the Memphis ghetto, who's sure to be basically either shot or something bad in the next few years if he's left where he is born, and he goes from that to being one of the most highly valued children on the planet because he's perceived to be a future NFL left tackle who's the second highest paid position on the football field. And he's got exactly the traits of an NFL left tackle. And so the question is, what are the forces in the world that enable this transformation from least to most valuable? And one of them was his relationship with this adoptive family. He had a mother who was all of a sudden on him. Without the mother, he's not in school, much less playing football. And another is what happens in football to transform the role that he's destined to play. And so the other piece of this puzzle was that after Moneyball came out, NFL front offices were interested in having conversations with me because they were interested in the book. And there was an executive in the NFL front office who had laid out to me what I didn't know, which is that this guy nobody has ever heard of who protects the quarterback's blind side, the left tackle, has become the second highest paid player on the field. And there's this kind of idea of the hidden celebrity, the person who's no one understands their value. It echoed very nicely Michael's story, too.
Well, that's also the story of Moneyball. Mm-hmm. That's, in some sense, the story in The Big Short. It's all about value and how people see value and how people miss value.
Yeah, that's true. That's absolutely true. That connects. That theme does connect those three books. It's very different versions of the same story, but this is a big question, and so yes, it's not. I'm drawn to that subject.
Yeah, obviously. So let's talk just a little bit about Moneyball. You were not the only one, I'm sure, who didn't think it was going to get made the day we read the news that 2 days before shooting, it had been shut down.
I was skeptical when the book was bought by Columbia to turn it into a movie. Billy Bean, now played by Brad Pitt, he'll forever now just be Brad Pitt. He might as well just walk away, because when people think Billy Bean, they're going to think Brad Pitt. But Billy Bean said, I don't really... He had misgivings about me writing a book that involved him. He was not very eager for this process. And when all of a sudden it might be a movie too, he says, I'm not really sure I want to go here. And I said, don't worry, they'll never make it. They buy these things and they never make it. And I've had more likely books and stories get bought and just vanish into the black box that is the Hollywood production process. And so I assured him it wouldn't get made. And after a few years, he said, you were right. This is great. We get this option money, and they just write us a check, and it's never going to get made. He was very pleased with the whole thing. And then it looked like it was going to get made. I mean, Steven Soderbergh was going to direct it. There were days before principal photography.
And as you say, they spent $10 million at that point.
Yes, they spent $10 million at that point. And Billy says, you know, you were wrong. They're making it. And then it falls apart. And he goes, no, you were right. They're not going to make it. And I thought at that point, it was so, it was such an embarrassment. And there were these big articles, and like the New York Times thought it was newsworthy that this movie had fallen apart, and there was a gleefulness in the coverage.
Yes.
That wasn't going to happen. Everybody was very happy that there was this disaster, and it made the studio look stupid, and so on and so forth. What I knew and believed was that the two people who mattered most in the whole process had not had a moment's hesitation even through it all. One was Brad Pitt. He was just going to find a different director to do it because the studio had been disenchanted with Steven Soderbergh. And the second was Amy Pascal, who ran Columbia, who said, you know, never mind the noise. We're gonna make this. It's just gonna take a little time.
I must tell you, Amy Pascal was a development girl. She was my development girl on Earth Girls Are Easy. Yeah. I mean,
well, she's an Earth girl, but she's not easy.
No.
But
I mean, if you had, I knew she was driven, I knew she was smart, and she was passionate about movies, but who knew this was going to be the head of a studio?
Well, and what I loved about her performance, and it really was a performance, was how nervy it was. It was, I don't care about the noise. The noise that most people have their lives guided by, what the New York Times says about them, that sort of thing. She just ignored it all and made a breathtakingly good movie. I mean, it is an unbelievably good movie. It's a movie that is almost sure to get an Oscar nomination. It tells you something. It's sort of like, if you just keep your eye on the right thing, like, we're going to make a good movie, and ignore all the rest, your chances are better.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Michael Lewis, best-selling author of The Blind Side, which also got an Oscar nomination, and is, I didn't know this, the most successful sports movie ever made at this point.
If success is measured in terms
money,
of money.
Dollars. Yeah, dollars. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. One could say Raging Bull or but the most successful.
You know what
money.
I like about it is not that. Yeah, I was told that it was the highest grossing movie with a female lead.
Yes.
And I thought that was great. That it was such a platform for an actress. I thought that was terrific.
That's a great combination if you think about it. Highest-grossing sports movie and highest-grossing movie with a female lead. We're talking today about Moneyball, the film based on his book, which is in theaters, and his newest book, Boomerang: Travels in the New Third World. You can learn more by going to Bloomberg.com or VanityFair.com and search for Michael Lewis, who writes for both of them, or just go to one of the theaters and see Moneyball. So I have a big appetite for sports, and I teach story and narrative to organizations when I'm not on the radio. And when I'm teaching them, I say sports writing is usually the best storytelling, certainly in newspapers, because I feel that they don't have to keep things tight to the vest, sort of. They have 162 games in a baseball season or 82 games in a basketball season, and they've got to make up a story that goes around those numbers. Your thoughts about that?
The athletes, you compare the athletes as subjects to politicians on the front page or business people in the business section. They have much less to lose from what gets written in the newspaper. So there's already an advantage that the writer has, that the athlete's willing to say some things that maybe other kinds of people aren't willing to say.
Yeah, what keeps drawing you to it?
Well, is that you don't have to write about sports. Sports is a way to get to other things. And I mean, Moneyball, to me, at the bottom, was a book about markets. It was about the way markets misvalue people. And The Blind Side was about many things, but it was an extension of this about how the world values this one person. And the sports, in some way, funny way, is a backdrop or an excuse. But it's also a source of action and movement. It's, you know, writing is about creating movement on the page. And it really helps if people are moving through space and bodies are colliding and so on and so forth.
And games have a time limit. Seasons have a time limit. You have a ticking clock usually.
And there's suspense.
That works for you.
There's suspense. There are very few aspects of American life where there's genuine suspense, where you don't know what's going to happen next. And all kinds of weird things might happen next. And you know.
And do.
And you know that it's not planned or rigged in some way. So you've got that going for you, too. So it's a place to set stories about all kinds of things. And the characters just generally are pretty rich. I mean, people's passions are invested in it. And it's not like you can rationalize. There's success and failure, and everybody acknowledges it. You know, someone lost and someone won. And the loser knows they lost and the winner knows they won.
You know, a thing that I always thought, having, as I said, I love sports and played a lot when I was young. And for a while, for a good part of my life, I was in the entertainment industry. Earth Girls Are Easy being the movie I got made.
The high point.
One of them, right. Yes. But I was also an actor. And what I realized as I looked around my own career and other people's career is that you can't hang on in sports the way you can hang on in entertainment. In other words, you can keep telling yourself you're the greatest thing since sliced bread. They just haven't noticed it. In baseball, if they start hitting home runs off you, or
it's harder to lie to yourself.
Yeah,
it's harder. You can still try it, but the world doesn't let you do it.
That's right.
They're cold hard realities in sports. There's a cleanness to it.
Yeah.
That makes it easy to set stories in. So sports isn't the only place I like to write.
Yeah.
I like to set stories, but sports, I came to sports not as a sports writer. I mean, it was very strange that I wrote Moneyball. I was 41 years old or 42 years old, and I'd never written a word about sports.
But as you say, it's a book about markets, and that you had written about.
Yeah, so I had an excuse.
You know, I want to talk about another book from back in that time, which was Trail Fever. Which was that was a hardback title,
and they wouldn't let me put the publisher would not let me put my title on the hardback, so I put it on the paperback,
which was Losers.
Losers, right? No one will buy a book about Losers.
Now
they were right about that, but no one will buy a book about Trail Fever either.
Now that's a book of yours that most people don't know about.
Yeah.
I'm Terrence McNally talking to Michael Lewis, and as I say, hardback Trail Fever, paperback Losers was about the '96 campaign, the '96 presidential campaign, and I read it. It was the first book of yours I read. I loved it. I said, it's smart, it's funny, it really has a lot to say about politics. You wrote for the New Republic.
Mm-hmm.
You wrote for Slate. You wrote a lot about politics years ago. Now, not so much in years. What's that to you?
Well, part of it is where I live. I was living in Washington. That made it very easy. Stuff was right under my nose. And part of it is who I was associated with. The New Republic was an explicitly political magazine.
But Vanity Fair certainly writes.
Oh, yeah, you know.
I mean, Boomerang certainly is about politics, as I said. Now finance, because the governments
absolutely
are in trouble, now
that's
finance
I'm, is about. I'm wandering around talking to heads of state and heads of the finance ministries.
Heads of ministries, yeah.
Yeah, so the Boomerang is funny. Losers, as I can't call it Trail Fever. It wasn't my title. Losers was a similar sort of exercise to Boomerang in that I knew I was writing a book, but I tricked it out in magazines. I plotted it. I plotted a book and then went out and wrote it in like a Dickens novel almost, right?
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, so I knew it was a book when I was writing the first word of it. And it was just a question of how it was going to get executed. And I thought in covering that campaign, the way I ended up doing it was saying, officially it's Bob Dole versus Bill Clinton, but that is the least interesting thing that's going on here. The campaigns are so essentially dishonest that they're and guarded that there's no point in trying to get to know those people. But there are all these other people running for president, and actually, it's great. At any given time, you have no idea how many people are running for president. You'd have no idea.
That's
you
right.
Think it's a dozen or whatever you see on TV. No. There are hundreds of people out here who think they're running for president, and they have eight passionate supporters. And so these people had these little passion groups that were wandering around the country with them, and it was a way to wander passionate political America, basically. Not manipulative, stage managed political America.
Right. In other words, when you're for like
Maury Taylor,
Grizz. When you're for him, it's not about the payoff. It's about something. It's about your passion.
Yes. The only reason you're for Ralph Nader in that book, Ralph Nader, Alan Keyes, or Pat Buchanan, or Maury Taylor, whoever it is because you really care about something that they say, not because you think they're going to win.
Yeah.
And so it was a way of identifying what people really cared about. And this was very important because what really people really care about tends to percolate up to the major candidates. There's that famous Richard Hofstadter line about third parties in America. It says they're like bees. First they sting and then they die. The ideas come from there. The change comes from there. And when it gets to a tipping point, the big parties co-opt it. And so if you want to see where the world's going, don't look at the big. Look below the big parties. Look at Occupy Wall Street.
I was just. You took the words. I was down at Occupy LA the other day. Did last week's show on that, and we will talk about that more probably towards the end. I think.
Okay.
We'll take Boomerang and then go. Okay. What was Occupy? But the thing that someone said to me is, they said, it was third parties that brought us suffrage and abolition and so on. And I said, well, Lincoln was basically a third-party candidate because he was the first Republican president.
Political change is a startup. It starts as a startup, and big successful parties have no taste for the risk of startups. The startups happen almost invisibly to most Americans, and then they grow and grow and grow, and then all of a sudden, hey, guess what? The Democratic Party just assimilated the views of Occupy Wall Street. And so that's what I was looking at, and that's what interested me. And, of course, then the characters are more accessible. They have nothing to lose.
Right. You want to talk to me? Great.
Yeah. Thanks. Come along. You want to stay in my house? That's really what happened. And you get to know it. You get to really know people. And so it was a way to breathe life into what was essentially a dead process. But you asked me why I don't write about politics?
Yeah.
The question is, having done that once, what else is there to do? And you could write about political policy. There are people who do that very well. It wouldn't be my strength. It's not my comparative advantage as a writer. Every now and then I find politicians in situations that are really interesting me. I did a couple of big pieces about John McCain. I almost went out with John McCain in the last campaign. I went out with him for 2 days and then decided it's going to be this problem again, that it's this kind of stage-managed, false event, and I don't really want to be a part of it. But I could see right now, I would love to write a piece about Barack Obama. And I may be headed in that direction. I mean, I got to get access, but if I can get in, that's the world through his eyes has not been properly described. And he could do it better than me, but he's not allowed to.
When you say that you'd like to write about Barack Obama and May, what's percolating in you? It's clear that you look for characters. You look for stories, but you really look for characters. You tell stories about ideas, but they're always built around characters. So when you say writing about Barack Obama, he's the character, what do you see?
One is a literary opportunity. He's misdescribed in the public debate about him. Both left and right are angry at him. Everybody's angry at him. I mean, it's an amazing achievement. This man was handed this horrible mess. I mean, this horrible mess. He walked into the least promising political environment one could walk into. Problems that were without solutions, and now solutions that were not going to please people. And he has struggled to find solutions. Struggled to build bridges to his opponents, and everybody hates him for it. And he. You can see there's this kind of longing to pin him to the page, to say, oh, now we know who this guy is after 3 years in office. He isn't who we thought he was.
That's one narrative.
One narrative. The other narrative is he is who we thought he was. And neither one of them sound true. Neither one of them appreciate the context in which he operates. He is a clearly very, very sensitive, very, very intelligent person. He's a rare writer who managed to become a president. And it just doesn't happen very often. Lincoln, I think, is the last one. I think JFK had people ghost his things.
I think so.
Yeah, no, the last person who actually had a felt literary sense was Lincoln.
Yeah.
And Obama has that.
Right.
Now,
it was one of the things that impresses me about Jim Webb, the senator from Virginia,
right,
is also a writer.
So he has the ability to go into a room alone and come out more interesting than he went in. Which the writers can do. They can go into a room alone and come out more interesting than they went in. They don't need help. And so I'm sure he's doing that. And his perspective on governing us has got to be very, very interesting. And I feel like all the descriptions I read about him, they're all animated by upset, by someone being upset with him, that they don't ring true. They don't capture the man I'm seeing in action. So I like to try to capture the man I'm seeing in action. And the only way you do that, though, is to be let in. And the odds of that are never great. You know, it would take them, they'd have to take some risk. But that's what I ask of subjects. I say, you know, what do you do to exercise? I'd say, you know, if he goes for a swim or goes and plays basketball, let me just come with you and do it. And let's just talk about what it's like to be in your shoes. Because I think if you put the American people in his shoes accurately, there'd be a lot more sympathy for him.
Right? Yeah.
There'd be a different sort of awareness of what he's dealing with. So I think he's a huge literary opportunity. He hasn't been done properly.
Except by himself. And
before he got to power.
And exactly. We have good literature about the early Barack Obama.
Yeah. And one day he will sit down and write a wonderful memoir. But that's a decade away.
Yeah.
And right now, I think there's kind of a need to walk in his shoes.
Yeah.
Never mind what you think about him. Let's walk in his shoes and see how it feels.
Well, let me just ask you one more thing about this. Would be just your take on it. His insistence on reaching across the aisle, his insistence on trying to, you know, get compromise, trying to get buy-in. For me, when on the stimulus bill, first major piece of legislation, he takes out $40 billion for the states, which ends up as a big part of, I mean, that crisis is dealt with in Boomerang,
right.
The crisis of states. He takes out $40 billion that would have gone to the states, would have helped states, would have been spent immediately to get Republican votes. He doesn't get a single vote.
Yeah.
To me, at that moment, I'd have said, what I just gave up and what they did to me in return, and they're hurting their own governors, they're hurting their own citizens and so on, that would have been a lesson learned. And yet he persisted and persisted and persisted. What do you make of that?
One of the reasons I want to write about him is that I don't have – these are great questions you want answered. They're all these questions you want answered. But I can imagine something like this going through his head. Before I declare a war, if I'm going to win the war – I have to demonstrate to the American people that I did everything possible to avoid the war, that I bent over backwards to have a civil relationship with the opposition, and the opposition demonstrated they were incapable of a civil relationship. Once that is not just said but shown, he may have different sorts of powers. So that's one thing might be going through his head. Yeah, this stinks. It's horrible how they behaved. But if we accumulate enough evidence about how they behave, maybe I can do different things to them and the American people will accept it and not hold it against me, kind of thing. I can imagine that story. And I can also imagine that they actually get kind of rolled sometimes. they get told one thing,
uh-huh,
and then another thing happens. It's pretty clear that the Republicans don't have control of themselves, right? I mean, there's more than one Republican Party at work right now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so he may not know who he's talking to. And maybe I'm sure he's learned. There's lots of mystery in the behavior of the Obama administration. There probably is a really good explanation for why they're doing what they're doing. The worst explanation is always, oh, the person's stupid. Let me tell you, these are not stupid people.
Right.
They're not stupid people, and they have more information than you have about why they're doing what they're doing. They may be wrong, but they're much more interestingly wrong than we know. It's sort of, that's the explanations of their behavior, which is either they're weak or they're stupid, just don't ring true. These don't ring true.
So that's part of what
that's
has
why
you
I'm
curious.
Interested. Yeah. So and I, it's there's a literary opportunity.
Yeah, that's Michael Lewis, and I'm Terrence McNally. We're talking about lots of things, and now we're going to shift very soon to talking about Boomerang. I did want to ask one more thing about writing, because Felix Salmon wrote an article in which he disparaged your piece on Germany, but he said something I found very interesting. He said that much of what Lewis does when reporting and writing his stories is simply unique. His technique is labor-intensive, which many people, it looks so facile, many people may not understand that. He talks to an enormous number of people, works out what story he wants to tell, and puts together various tales and individuals he's discovered over the course of his reporting in the service of telling that story in the most entertaining and compellingly readable way. It doesn't matter how important you are or whether you've given Lewis an important nugget. If it doesn't help the structure of the story, he'll happily leave it out. That was an interesting take on what you do.
Well, that's true. I mean, that's a fair description. He wouldn't know because he's just guessing.
He guessed.
It's true that it's curious to me, that when people read what I've written, they sort of assume that everything that I found out is in the story, and the vast majority of what I found out is not. And we said before that writing is in part about what you leave out. And so it is entirely possible, for example, that if I got let into the Obama administration and Obama gave me an interview, that the reader might never know it, that I could write the whole story about Obama and his voice wouldn't be there if it didn't seem like it was relevant. That the job I think I do is just that, is just sort of try to figure out what's going on here, make sense of the situation, and find the narrative that explains what I've figured out, that draws the reader into what I've figured out. And it's messy, you know. It usually involves trying to eliminate all preconceptions I have going in. And it also involves talking to almost in a kind of scattershot approach to lots of different kinds of people. So you have different eyes on the subject and different points of view on the subject before coming to any real conclusions about it.
And the other thing I read in what he said, and it seemed to ring true, is that you're also always looking for the characters characters in Big Short, you know, are outliers, outlaws in some sense in that thing. And yet that's how you tell the story. It's not the people that everyone else has heard about. How important is that to you to find, or as we talked about the political story, it was the characters?
It's obviously very important when it comes to the writing of it. This is weird. This will sound weird, but it's true. I don't think that way. I don't think I'm looking for a character. And I don't know exactly why that is. Usually what I'm looking for is an idea or a notion or an interesting question to answer. And I interview lots of people. I get to know lots of people. And when I sit down to write, I realize, oh, this is actually someone I can make swing on the page. This guy actually...
So it's in that stage of the process. It's in that stage of the process that the importance of the characters emerge.
Yes, it's not the early stage. It's not, oh, I'm going to find these characters and then I'll figure out what I'm going to let them do all the work.
Although you did say in your Charlie Rose interview that you were on a casting search,
but
that's how you found Kyle Bass.
That's a good example. By the time I went on that casting search, I was 9 months into reporting the book. I'd done all this other stuff. And then it wasn't until I got almost to the end of the process that I realized what's important here are the starting point for a reader is going to be these people who either saw it coming or might as well have seen it coming because they made a fortune off the collapse.
We're talking
of
about Big Short at
that
point. Yeah.
It was the Big Short. There were these handful of people who were in a very privileged position in relation to the financial crisis. And I needed to go talk to all of them and figure out which ones would be the best to tell the story through. But by that point, I knew what the story was. So it wasn't, they didn't come exactly last, but they came pretty late in the process.
Okay, let's talk about Boomerang. Boomerang is articles that appeared in Vanity Fair, and unlike what you said happened with the Losers, it was built on magazine articles, this time the articles are literally Boomerang, aren't they?
There's a section in the front that weren't.
Yeah.
But the articles were plotted as a book. The only reason I did the articles was because there was a book, and I knew where I wanted to go, what order I wanted to unspool this thing, and where it was going to end. So what I did is basically use Vanity Fair to get it out of me. And the book was, I realized when I was working, and I worked on it contemporaneously with The Big Short. I realized when I was working on The Big Short two things. One was there was this, it wasn't just a U.S. debacle, of course, it was a global financial disaster. But that, as Kyle Bass, a hedge fund manager in the very beginning of Boomerang, puts it, you know, the collapse of the subprime mortgage bond market is just, and Lehman Brothers going down and so on and so forth, is just act one of the financial crisis. We're still in it. And the banks around the world assumed, have all these bad debts. Governments assumed the debts of the banks, basically, or backs up them. And there are many governments that can't afford to pay off their cumulative debts. So the next question is, what happens when governments aren't credible? And related to that is, why do these societies get themselves in this position? And they each got themselves in the position in a different way.
That's right. You return again and again in Boomerang to this notion that each country or culture found itself alone in a dark room with a pile of money.
Yes, it's a story of temptation. I mean, it's a temptation on the individual level, but also on the level of the society, that what happened was banks, our financial system, stopped doing its job. It's the banks, bankers, lenders are supposed to be the brakes.
Lenders, yeah.
Yeah, they're supposed to be the brakes in the financial system. They're supposed to decide what they're supposed to parse risk and evaluate risk and not make the loans that are bad risks. They cease to discriminate properly. They made lots and lots and lots of loans to people, to countries, to companies, other banks they should never have made.
I'm going to jump in for a quick question. Obviously, when a bank was just a bank, they had to pay more attention to that. Size turns out to be a big factor here. But isn't it that when a bank is also an investor and can short sell, now it doesn't have to be quite so careful about the risk?
Well, this is true. It's true because in its own head, If it takes some risk over with his left hand, it can offset it with his right.
Which it didn't used to be able to do.
But in fact, they didn't do in a lot of cases. You know, that when the subprime mortgage bond market collapses, who owns the big piece of it? Citigroup and Merrill Lynch and so on, Morgan Stanley and so on and so forth. But they could tell themselves that they were managing this risk even as they weren't. It's true that when the banks are taking big securities positions, they can delude themselves into thinking they have better risk management than they do. I think that is true.
But nonetheless.
Nonetheless, this, to get back to the thrust of the story, it's, I saw it as people and cultures being tempted by this pile of money that was put in front of them. And what do they want to do with it when it was put in front of them? And their relationship with money became a window into the culture. So it was an excuse for a kind of travel journalism. I mean, that's how I thought of this. It was financial disaster travel journalism.
And travel journalism, like sports, has movement. It has a dynamic.
Well, this is exactly right. I mean, when I wrote my first book, Liar's Poker, I wrote it essentially as a travel book, and that created the movement. And what was going to create the movement is me moving through space.
And this one, you even have it in the title.
Yes.
Travels in the New Third World.
Yes.
You make no bones about it. So let's go through them quickly. Greece.
In every case, what the money did is exaggerate tendencies that were already in the culture. And in Greece, the tendency was to abuse the government, the state, to use the state as a kind of pinata filled with goodies for everybody to take a whack at. On the one hand, you know, jobs that you get a job. If you're a Greek citizen, you count on the state to give you a job you don't have to turn up for, kind of thing. The state, I mean, one piece of information, this is just breathtaking, but so the Greek National Railroad has annual revenues of 100 million euros, pays out 400 million euros in salaries.
In
salaries. And
that doesn't mean they bought any trains.
The average salary, if you're an employee of the Greek National Railroad, is 65,000 euro a year, which is more than any private company in Greece pays. So this is an indication of the scope of the problem.
And they don't pay their taxes.
Well, on the other side, they don't pay their taxes. In fact, it's endemic to the culture. You're regarded as a fool if you pay your taxes. So it's a totally dysfunctional and corrupt society. And Greek people will tell you that themselves. There was nothing I could say about Greek people that they didn't say about themselves, and worse. They don't trust each other.
And this is the birthplace of democracy. But we'll just leave that out.
We'll leave that out, because it actually has very little connection.
There was a culture, but it was very different. And they're angry at the Germans now.
They're angry at the Germans because they see themselves as repaying the Germans the money they borrowed. And in order to do it, the government is imposing on the people very harsh terms to them. It means making their state functional, making them pay
balancing
their taxes.
Balancing a budget,
But there are German tax collectors in Greece trying to collect taxes from Greek people. So there's a sense of loss of sovereignty. And they have lost control of their fiscal sovereignty for now.
Yeah.
So you have this very weird situation where people who borrowed a lot of money for not productive purposes are in the streets rioting because they have to pay it back. It's not a good sign. The idea that this is simply a financial matter is nonsense. It's a cultural one. And you can't change the culture fast enough to solve the problem. So they're going to default. The question is what happens when they default.
Right.
And when they default, it ripples through the financial world because everybody who lent money to the Greeks is out of pocket.
Right. So Greek banks fail, okay. But what you're saying is there's investment in Greece from all the other countries.
French banks are going to fail.
And France, a big country.
Yeah.
So since Germany, we've introduced Germany to the story, Germany's response to that pile of money.
The German response to the pile of money was breathtakingly interesting to me because the German people behaved impeccably. They completely resisted the temptation. German culture still has built into it the importance of delayed gratification and a caution, a sense that bad, really bad things can and will happen, so you better save for that moment. So the German people didn't inflate their land prices. They didn't borrow money to buy cars. They don't even have credit cards, really. I mean, they, when they pay with plastic, it's always a debit card.
Oh,
they don't.
My God.
They don't have the idea that you borrow money to consume is anathema in Germany. So the German people just ignored the temptation. The German banks behaved in some ways worse than any banks in the world.
They were the mark.
They were the suckers.
On the other side.
They were the suckers.
I mean, that was true in The Big Short.
This is what one of the things I knew going in was that when the subprime mortgage market collapsed here, when all those subprime-backed bonds collapsed, everybody's trying to get out at once. So Merrill Lynch is trying to get out of what it owns, and UBS is trying to get out of what it owns. And more and more big players got out of the market. There were fewer and fewer people to sell to. And when you asked anybody on Wall Street, who's the last buyer of this stuff? The answer was always Germans. Dusseldorf. The Germans were the last to get out. They were the last to see it. And what's even weirder is, in the American system, the American financiers were oddly paid to make bad loans. I mean, this is what's so screwed up, is people made fortunes making really stupid financial decisions.
They were incentivized to just get big.
And the losses were going to be realized by someone else. So it was a question of really of incentives here. The German bankers never paid themselves money. I mean, small sums. They were six-figure guys. So there was never a big incentive, personal financial incentive, to get involved in these markets. But they did every stupid thing you could do with money, they did it. They lent the money to the Icelandic banks to get huge. They lent money to the Greek government. They bought U.S. subprime bonds. They bought lots of – they invested one way or another in Spanish real estate. The only thing they missed, the only bullet they dodged, was Bernie Madoff. And the only reason they dodged it is there are basically no Jews in German finance. I mean, and if there had been Jews in German finance, they'd have found that too. So the question was, how does this happen? How do the people behave so well and the bankers behave so badly?
And because we're running, we've got about 5 minutes left, and I do want to get back to Occupy Wall Street. So I'm going to skip Iceland. I'm going to skip Ireland, except in Iceland, to say that it's worth looking at. One of the things is male-dominant risk takers, and when the stuff really hit the fan, women took over the banks and the government.
It's a lesson for us. Men and money are a very dangerous combination. Male overconfidence has been shown in lots of academic research to lead to bad financial decision making. And women are actually better with money than men. And Iceland, this was the male domination of the money end of things. They make their money from fishing. The men were the fishermen. The men walked off the boats and into the banks and became investment bankers basically overnight. And the women let them do it because they kind of assumed they knew what they were doing. And they didn't know what they were doing. When it all comes crashing down, the women made them stop. And the women moved into the banks in senior roles. And the government fell, and they have the first lesbian head of state in the world.
And they've drafted a new constitution. I mean, what Iceland has done after hitting the wall is quite impressive.
It is impressive. And one of the impressive things was they walked away from a lot of their debts. It was so big they couldn't repay
it. But that's what bankruptcy does. It gives you a chance to be reborn.
And they're going to be fine.
Yeah. I think the next chapter of Iceland is an interesting story.
Yes, it is.
But we don't have time to talk about
it. Sorry.
Okay. Ireland, we're not going to talk about, but that's worth. California.
Yes.
That was one that surprised me. So how did California run up such enormous debts? I mean, I've got numbers here, but I don't have time to get into them. But, you said that thing about the Greek railroad, where the salaries and so on. I mean,
all these different foreign countries are distant mirrors of our own culture. We have, in some way, we can see in our own society echoes of the problems in each of these places. And the echo of Greece is in the relationship between our public employees unions and the government. And California is an especially obnoxious example. But the public safety workers in city after city cut deals that have effectively either bankrupted the city or brought them to the verge of bankruptcy. And so fire and police. If you ask the same question of America that I asked of these other societies, what did this event tell you about the society? And there were two things that were quite obvious in America. One was, we're perfectly willing to let the strong exploit the weak. We allow our rich elites on Wall Street to exploit weak people. And our public safety workers actually are in a position of great strength. We're at their mercy in some ways. They protect us. And no politician wants to be seen standing up against the police force or the fire department. So they had enormous...
And in California, also the prison unions.
And the
prison industrial complex
right.
in California. Now, the one thing that... And I'm just going to throw this out and give me a very quick response if you want to. But it seems to me the thing that you leave out there is that happened also when it became very, very difficult to raise taxes. So these bubbles are going on. we're giving this public safety union.
It's the same story as Greece.
Exactly.
We don't want to pay taxes.
That's right. And so, as you say, Mark Paul says, California works the way the people want it to.
They want
lots of services, and they don't want to pay for them.
That's exactly
and
right.
And so there are both sides to that.
Absolutely.
And you're very easy on Arnold Schwarzenegger in it, and you leave out the fact that his first action was to get rid of the auto tax that cost us $4 to $5-6 billion a year, and at a time when we shouldn't have done that.
Yeah, but he also raised taxes later. And now, this is what I'll say about it's the point about Arnold Schwarzenegger that I find interesting is that he really was what people imagine politicians need to be. Totally independent, walking in. He had he could do what he wanted to do, and he did try, as Mark Paul, an independent analyst, said, everything.
Yeah.
He tried to be a Democrat. Yeah. He tried to be a Republican. He tried to go directly to the people. Nothing worked.
But I will also say, I think he always tried it from that position of entitlement that he's grown into. As you say, you quote him, you ask him if, I asked Schwarzenegger how much time he had spent as governor grappling with the on-the-ground local implications of the big state crisis, and he says, you say the question pretty clearly bored him. I'm not into the local stuff. I was born for the world. I have a feeling that Arnold never saw what was happening to other people.
Now, we started this interview by you saying it's important to leave holes for the reader to walk into. So people who hate Arnold Schwarzenegger, as you clearly do, can walk into my piece and find evidence to support their feelings. But people who are more kindly disposed can also walk into it and find evidence to support their feelings.
Hate's a little strong, but okay. What do you think of Occupy Wall Street?
I think it's a really good thing. It's a really healthy sign because I was afraid that essentially what we were going to get is just despair. That for the young people especially, we're going to say, what's the point? I can't change anything. And what these people are saying is I can change something. And it is so outrageous what's happened in this country that the elites caused this problem. They literally, the people who are paid the most, caused this financial crisis. They are bailed out by the taxpayer. And then once bailed out and restored to health, they do their best to prevent reform of the system. And the system badly needed pretty draconian reform. It's outrageous.
They've broken the social agreement, sort of. We'll bail you out. Now, when we come to reform you, work with us.
They broke two rules. They broke their own rules of capitalism. They should have all failed. They'd all been out of business if the government hadn't stepped in. And then they seemed to think that they were owed it afterwards. And I think that that kind of unfairness will leave you either cynical and despairing or angry and ready to change things. And it's really good that people are angry and ready to change
things. So to you, the Occupy movement, ill-defined as it may be, is a good sign and has real possibility.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, is that something you'd write about?
Yes.
Yeah. I would think that would be something interesting.
Yes. But it's just started.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So the new book is Boomerang, Travels in the New Third World. The film Moneyball is in theaters, and a couple of websites to read more are Bloomberg.com and VanityFair.com. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime during the week by linking to our podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly. For podcast articles, transcripts, go to aworldthatjustmightwork.com or terrencemcnally.net. They're the same website. You can sign up there for you can get the podcast. You can sign up also to have it delivered to you weekly there or at iTunes. You can also sign up there or by emailing me at temcnally@mac.com. Finally, thank you to Michael Lewis. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.